You're listening to Radio DePaul. I'm Connor Mudd, and this is Tom Talks.
Hello, and welcome to episode 19 of Tom Talks, our Jerry Maguire episode. With me today is a very special guest. She is a classically trained pianist who hates jazz. She used to cook ribeye steaks over open flames on the Oregon Trail, and she once had a coworker call HR on her because she types too fast. Welcome to the show, my mom, Andrea Culhane.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. I'm just going to call you mom because it feels weird to call you by your first name.
Because you know what's strange is that moving up here, my maiden name has like power and clout in this teeny tiny town. So I'm definitely using the like Myers Culhane more. And so I don't even know who I am. So mom, that sounds like that's my favorite title. Let's go with that.
Yeah. And the reason that I wanted to bring you on for this one, this was initially going to be my birthday special, but I had to cancel
pandemic.
All of last quarter. So we're going to call this my half birthday special because I am now 21 and a half years old as of 4 days ago.
Yes.
It's the lamest special we could possibly have on this show.
Yeah.
We had our election special. We had our Halloween special. Now here we are.
It's your half birthday special.
My half birthday special.
Depressing.
I don't know if I've ever, I've heard the vague story of why Jerry Maguire was on, but I don't remember it in full.
Yeah, so I heard your version that you told Asher, that Jerry Maguire was somehow the first like sound you heard as a child. So I guess we can start it's part of your birth story. So your birth story began on April Fool's Day, 1999, which was not 21 and a half months ago. That was 21 and a half years ago. That was 21 and like 7 months ago. But you attempted to come way too early. And I went into labor and you just decided you wanted to come out and tell the ultimate April Fool's joke. They decided that they wanted you to be able to breathe and eat. So they gave me a bunch of drugs, kept me in the hospital. And then they sent me home to just chill out for a few weeks and try to get you to your due date, which was May 12th. You weren't due until mid-May. Sad part of the story, trying to find something funny because Columbine had just happened.
Ooh.
And so Columbine happened April 20th. We got a little consumed. You know, Tori was 15 months old, had just learned to walk. She had gone to bed, like I was exhausted, had a, you know, super pregnant. So we put on Jerry Maguire at home just to chill out. At this point, they decided that if I made it till April 28th or 29th, they would induce me so that you could just be, I was miserable. It was time. So we just finally relaxed. It was like this weird relaxation moment. And I got up to go to the bathroom because that's basically what you do as your full-time job when you're pregnant at 9 months. And yeah, I was pretty sure I'd like peed my pants, but I had not. But I wasn't sure. And the internet is not at that moment what it is now. So it's not like Google, like you could just be like, well, what? I got out my book and it was like, here's what you do to know if your water has broken or if you've just peed your pants. So I laid on the ground on the bathroom floor and was like, nope, this is definitely my water breaking. So it was like 10:30 at night, called your grandma Nancy to say, I need you to come over and watch Tori. And she'd been asleep. And so she kept saying, are you sure? Like, you know, we'd had a couple of false starts with you. We're like, we knew we were going to induce. I'm like, I am 100% sure that this kid is coming. So it just happened that Jerry Maguire was like the chill out movie that finally made me relax enough to just go into labor with you. And so forever, whenever I see Jerry Maguire, I'm like, I went into labor with this kid, and like 2 hours later, he was born, because you came really quickly once we got to the hospital. And you were 8 pounds and 9 ounces, and the nurses said you looked like a C-section baby. You were very pretty, and you held your head up as a newborn, which is not supposed to be. So in retrospect, you probably should have been born April 1st, because you were a big baby.
Mm-hmm.
That's Jerry Maguire. You didn't hear it.
Sure. I figured it wasn't as serendipity as like it just happened to be on in the hospital,
right,
or something. Is it your favorite Tom Cruise movie, or is it just like the one that chills you out a little bit?
I would say that as far as the one that has the most like smiley memories, it definitely is right up there. It's probably one of my favorites. Unlike most of your guests, I've seen a lot of, if not all of, the Tom Cruise movies.
I don't think you've seen all of Tom Cruise's movies.
I'm coming close. Definitely more than most of your guests added up to this point.
That's true. Don't get me wrong, that's true. But I don't think you've seen all of them, just because of the weird, obscure ones.
That's true. I haven't seen like some of his early stuff. So I would say that it's right there. I think that A Few Good Men is a really, really close second, and I can probably quote more of A Few Good Men simply because we watched it obsessively when we were in high school and in mock trial, and then every single time it's on, it just stays on. I don't care if I have to watch commercials. If I can watch him, like, you know, the "you can't handle the truth," I just need those wholesome moments. But yeah, I did rewatch Jerry Maguire back in February when I was thinking I was coming out to visit you for your mm-hmm. birthday episode. And so I'm not sure it holds up that great.
Yeah, it definitely, it's an interesting one. I did watch it on my birthday. That was like my birthday celebration, was watching Jerry Maguire with friends on Netflix party.
Yeah.
Few Good Men and Jerry Maguire are both some of the most quotable movies of all time. I think the American mm-hmm. Film Institute has 3 Jerry Maguire quotes on their top 50 list and 1 Few Good Men quote on it.
Which surprised me that it wasn't flipped, but let me think. What would Show Me the Money, of course.
Show Me the Money.
Help Me Help You.
I don't even know if that one was on there.
Oh my gosh, I say that one all the time. That is a catchphrase that I use all the time. And then The Human Head Weighs 8 pounds.
No, you're missing like the two best ones.
You Complete Me.
That's one of them, yeah. The most iconic quote from any romantic comedy ever that's made fun of in like every spoof of a romantic comedy ever.
Oh my gosh, well, I guess I've just revealed what my favorite lines are. Tell me which one is the most one.
You had me at hello.
Oh, you had me at hello. God, I hated that line. That's probably why I've blocked it out, because I just felt like, really? He had you at hello? Like, let him talk. Whatever. Yeah, I forgot you had me at hello. I was still pretty fascinated by the help me help you.
Help me help you.
Help me.
Iconic.
I will text people, like clients that are having a little meltdown, I'll text them that gif, like, help me help you.
And you do, yeah, we haven't talked about like what you do as much. You're a real estate agent, but not where you live.
I am a real estate agent licensed in the state of Colorado, primarily in Denver, and I live in Scottsbluff and Gearing, Nebraska, about 3.5 hours away, because prior to the pandemic, I made this decision, which people don't, they think I made it because of yay COVID. But prior to it, my grandpa, your great grandpa, is still living. And I thought I would like to see him as much as possible for as long as he's still hanging out. My parents, you know, they'll swear they're not, and I know they're going to listen, but they are getting older. And so we found ourselves traveling up here pretty frequently. So decided to simplify our lives, Pete went back to work as a teacher. Cost of living is a wee bit lower here in good old Western Nebraska. And yet the teacher wages are better than in Denver, Colorado. So life is pretty good. And I can go back down as I need to. But in some ways, that's been one of the silver linings of COVID, is that it's helped my clients understand that, like, what they're paying me for is my brain and my ability to fight with people on the phone. And I can fight with them in Nebraska just as well as I can in Colorado, or someday I can fight with them in Chicago or in Virginia or in California or anywhere. I can go anywhere. So yes, that's what I do. But also I'm writing a book, which is more fun than any of that boring stuff.
Right. Writing a book is fun. Give an elevator pitch of the book for listeners at home who might want to read it someday.
Yeah. So it's loosely based on a collection of letters that were sent to my grandmother during World War II by five different soldiers fighting around the world while she was back at home working at a German prisoner of war camp in the middle of nowhere, Nebraska.
Exciting. So it'll be a little romance, historical fiction, probably?
Yes. Yes. We've got the elements of romance. There's a lot of, there'll be a little bit of young adult angst as she's forced to put her life on hold as a sophomore in college because of things outside of her control. And be at a distance from all of the things that she wants to be doing in her normal life. So I don't know, might feel a little familiar to some of the folks right now.
Maybe a little.
Yeah.
With you typing 100 words a minute, the book writing must be going very quick.
You would think so. You would think when I am in the groove, yes, it types very quickly. I don't know that my creativity works at 100 words a minute. That's been the challenge, is the creativity and then just keeping the head in the game in these, what every marketing executive says, these trying times.
These unprecedented times.
I'm so tired of that phrase.
Sure. Well, I should ask
you. Oh. Just a complete aside, did you know that there was an essence email during World War II?
I did not. How?
Yeah, I'll have to show you.
It wasn't an internet.
Yeah, no, they would take letters and you would scan them and they would be on this, basically an electronic mail. And then you'd write on it and then they would take a picture of it and shrink it down onto a microfiche, ship that, which would have thousands and thousands of letters, and then they would print them off really tiny. So you have all these teeny tiny, you know, I'll show you when you get here, but I was just shocked by that. That was a piece of trivia that I didn't think you knew.
Yeah, I definitely.
For when trivia comes back.
I will remember that email was predated the internet.
Yeah.
Which feels weird. When did you get your first email address, like, actually?
In college at the University of Wyoming. I was LTLRed at uwyo.edu because that was before they realized they should not let college kids pick their own email addresses. So I think mine was pretty appropriate. I mean, but none of us were using like A. Myers at UWYO or any of that. So yeah, that was back in 1993. I think 93, maybe 94, honestly. Because I think my first year of college, I didn't even have a computer. I had a word processing typewriter, and some people had computers. And then you could go to a computer lab. So that's how much time has changed since 1993.
So you got an email the same year of Tom Cruise's The Firm.
Yes. Yeah, that was a cheesy movie. But yes, that was my first email.
Well, here, there's two more questions that I ask all of my guests. You are an avid listener, so you should know these questions. You might have prepared answers. I don't even know. But the first is, what is the most Tom Cruise thing that you have ever done?
I raced a train in a Pinto station wagon to try to beat it through the train crossing.
Did you win?
I did, obviously. Obviously, I did win. It was the dumbest thing that I've ever done. I that car should not have gone that fast. I'm sure that I'm going to get grounded now that this is. I'm sure there will be some absolute pushback from your grandparents. But yes, I had a carload of my friends. I had just got my license. I was an absolute like Lifetime movie moment waiting to happen as my friends and I were like, you can make it, you can do it. A bunch of like smarty, nerdy girls with me who just really love to drive fast. I would say that is probably the most Tom Cruise like risky thing. And then just the way I drive is always Tom Cruise.
True. He, you know, he drives too fast in most of his movies. He's not in as many car chases as as other action heroes. Like James Bond is in a car chase every single movie.
Right. He's in motorcycle chases, and I honestly think it's so that he looks tall. I think he looks too short in cars.
Did you know that he did not know how to ride a motorcycle until he learned on the lot of a dealership for Top Gun?
Really?
Yeah. So he learned, and once he had learned, he wanted to do it in every single movie. So movie after that, he rode a motorcycle, which is pretty funny to me.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not a fan of the motorcycle. It would not be something that I ever really want to be a part of. But as far as driving fast, that is my Tom Cruise-iest characteristic.
For sure. And then I think you're familiar with this next part. I'm going to give you 1 minute for you to say whatever you want to Tom Cruise in the event that he ever listens. I'm going to super cut all of these together and we'll just have one long message to Tom. And your 1 minute starts now.
All right, Tom. First of all, thank you for inspiring my son to start his first podcast. I think of all of the things that he's interested in. Tom Cruise was not on my top 10 of the things that his first podcast would be about. So I am grateful to your film slate that has inspired this and opened us up to spreadsheets of knowledge about movies. So thank you for that. That's number one. Number two, it is okay to be a short person. I am not very tall and I am okay with that. I don't wear lifts. I used to wear heels. They're not comfortable, but you can just stop wearing lifts in your shoes. You don't need to stand on apple boxes in your movies. Ladies are all going to be taller than you and that is okay. You are good enough at what you do to be a short man who does it.
That's phenomenal. You were the first person to tell him that it's okay to be short. Probably in his whole life. That's too funny. I don't even remember when he started.
I did not prepare. I had forgotten about that question, but I was like, okay, here we go.
I can't remember. I honestly think that Top Gun is when he started wearing lifts in his shoes too, if I'm not mistaken. That was his first film where he stood on boxes and wore lifts.
I'm curious if they had to put like a booster seat in the fighter jet.
Oh, for sure. Just a little one is my guess. Just a phone book.
Yeah, probably. I mean, that's what I want. I don't want to interview Tom Cruise. I want to know the guy that's had to make him look tall and yet consistent. I mean, that's a hell of a set designer to be like, okay, Tom, like you and Nicole are the same height here. So how do we constantly get this so you're the same height?
Well, that brings us to our first commercial break. Stay tuned after this. We are going to play a game of Show Me the Money.
Biking in Chicago is more than just a mode of transportation. It's a lifestyle. It's convenient, affordable, and with 13,000 bike racks, parking is never a problem. But with every reward comes a sidecar of risk. In Chicago, over 1,700 cyclists a year are killed or injured in bike accidents involving motor vehicles. Bike safety is simple. First, become familiar with Chicago bike laws. Know your hand signals and when to use them. Love your brain. Get a bike helmet that fits your noggin and deck it out with a headlamp and some reflective gear for riding at night. Bike at least 3 to 4 feet away from parked cars to avoid being struck by a car door being open. Motorists can do their part, too, by checking their side view mirrors for bike traffic before exiting their vehicle. Most importantly, remember that we're sharing the road. Looking out for both ourselves and each other is the only way to keep Chicago's roads safe, no matter what your wheels look like. For more information on bike safety in Chicago, visit www.chicagobikes.org. This public service announcement was brought to you by Radio DePaul, Chicago's College Connection.
You're listening to Radio DePaul. Awarded Best Station in the Nation 2020.
Hello and welcome back. You're listening to Radio DePaul. I'm Connor Mudd and this is Tom Talks. I'm here with my mom and we are going to play a game of Show Me the Money. This game involves me giving a list of things that have numerical values associated with them. And my mom will have to put them in the order from smallest to largest. There will be four rounds. The first round, there are four things that are put in the correct order. The second round adds three more things to the list. The third round, two more things. And in the final round, you just have to place one number in the correct order. As always on my show, the winner gets nothing. Because what am I gonna give them? Without further ado, we're going to start round number one, the four facts that you have to put in numerical order are the year in which a Tom Cruise film was last nominated for an Oscar, the number of Oscars the cast of Magnolia has been nominated for other projects than Magnolia, the screen time in seconds for Holly Hunter's Oscar-nominated performance in The Firm, and the number Cuba Gooding Jr. wears on his jersey in Jerry Maguire. So you tell me where to put these things if you think one is higher than the other.
I think that the number Cuba Gooding Jr. is the smallest, and then the screen time for Holly Hunter's Oscar-nominated performance, and then the number of Oscars the cast of Magnolia has been nominated. And then finally, if we're counting the year in which a Tom Cruise film was last, just any film that he's involved in?
Yes.
So like 1990, whatever. I think that's the order, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
So what number do you think Cuba Gooding Jr. wears on his shirt, if you think it's that low?
I feel like it's 30-something, but I cannot remember it and I can't see it in my mind. And I thought she was only on like the number of seconds. It was like 180 or some sort of like, or.
But you think that the number of Oscars that the cast of Magnolia has been nominated for outside of that is higher than 30?
Maybe flip those. I think that for the whole cast of Magnolia.
It is a phenomenally storied cast.
Yeah. So, I mean, I feel like it's not the smallest, but I don't know. There you go. That's my final answer. It's probably all wrong.
All right. We'll start from the bottom here. You got correct. 2008
okay.
was the last
oh, wow.
year. Tropic Thunder was nominated for an Oscar.
Oh God. I forgot about that movie. Yeah. Okay.
The next one, Holly Hunter was on screen for 359
okay.
seconds.
Okay.
Very short amount of time. The next one,
Cuba
Gooding
Jr.
were 85.
Okay. I see threes and eights is about the same number. So.
They're essentially the same. You had the right idea. 19
okay.
is the answer. It would
okay.
be 20 if we counted Magnolia, but for projects other than Magnolia, it's only 19. The
okay.
only actor to get nominated for Magnolia was Tom Cruise.
All right, next one.
Okay.
I'm ready.
So the next one, you have to fit them in with the ones you already have. So now knowing
okay.
the order, the number of Oscars,
1985, 359, 2008. Okay.
Yeah. So the
Ooh.
next next three items here is the amount of money Tom Cruise has made on the entire Mission Impossible series, the amount of money Tom Cruise was paid for Risky Business, and the amount of money Tom Cruise was paid for Jerry Maguire.
Well, I mean, these are all bigger than 2008. So they're all going to be down because he made more than $2,008 on any of these. So I would say...
That's a safe bet.
I would say Risky Business, Jerry Maguire, Mission Impossible series.
So you guessed that these ones correctly, certainly.
Yeah, okay.
But these first ones are all there. Risky Business, he made $75,000 on Risky Business.
Wow.
Very low. He was young. He was very
young. He was a baby.
Jerry Maguire's correct, $20 million. And the entire Mission Impossible series, $205 million.
That's a lot of dollars.
That's a lot of dollars. Cool. So
you can afford to jump on Oprah's couch. You can just write a check. I ruined your couch. Here's $1 million.
Buy 10 couches.
Buy them all. Buy all the couches.
So now we have that whole list. Here's two more.
Okay.
So fit into that list the number of times Tom Cruise did the Halo jump to film the Mission Impossible Fallout scene where he does a Halo jump, and then the distance in feet that Tom Cruise has run on screen in his movies.
The distance in feet, not in miles?
Yep, in feet. It's easier to measure it in feet because the technology used to track it is like checking feet per second. And finding like his average speed and then the FPS of the film itself. So,
all right. So I feel like he can't have done that many Halo jumps because I'm not sure that whoever would do it would let him do 19 Halo jumps. I mean, that's an expensive stunt to do over and over and over again. So I think that that's the very first one. I think that's fewer than Magnolia.
Okay.
I think it's probably like 12 times that he did a Halo jump. And even then, that's a lot. And distance in feet. I feel like I don't think he's run 20 million feet.
That'd be a lot of feet.
A lot of feet. But I definitely think he's run more than 75,000 feet. So he's in between Risky Business and Jerry Maguire.
Okay. Do you want to lock in your answers?
I'm still really... Still, the problem with the Halo jump one is that I could see him being like just a crazy Tom Cruise and wanting to keep doing it and just be like, even if they got the shot, he's like, I want to do it again. I want to do it again. But I'm still going to stick with, I think it's less than 19. Yep. Final answer.
Okay. Final answer. I'm going to go up from the bottom. So we know you are correct in that those bottom two stay where they are. Above that, above 20 million, still the amount he was paid for business. Above that, 24,000.
Okay, feet. Okay, that seems, I guess, in actual on screen.
Yeah,
not in rehearsal. Okay.
Yeah, if it was in rehearsal and in his real life, I'm sure he runs marathons on his weekends. No doubt.
Yeah. No doubt. Most short men do.
Yep. And looking at the rest of them, he did the Halo jump.
Oh my gosh.
106 times. Not every single one was filmed, but in rehearsals through filming, he did it 106 times. And it is a one continuous take shot of him jumping out of that airplane.
Yeah, with where he's
very little special effects. It's pretty much just practical effects. And then they added in a cloud, and that's it.
106 Halo jumps.
Mm-hmm. They initially prepped him in a wind tunnel, but then he would go on the jumps just to like be super accustomed to it.
Well, and because you know that he wanted to do the most Tom Cruise thing he could possibly do.
Right. It was really hard to top him swinging on the side of the Burj Khalifa. So to do that, he taught himself how to Halo jump.
He's got to be such an adrenaline junkie. Okay. Wow. That's an exciting number.
Yeah, that, I was so surprised when I read that. I was like, really? Oh.
That's an interesting fact. All right.
Okay. This time there's only one new number. The national gross revenue of the first Top Gun movie. So not international, just national.
Just national. But, okay, so we've got syndication and DVD streaming. First theater run merchandise, is that included?
I honestly don't know how Box Office Mojo calculates these numbers. But however Box Office Mojo is calculating these numbers.
And now is the Mission Impossible series, is that just national or is that also international?
That's just how much he has made.
Oh.
Yeah, that's not how much Mission Impossible has made. Mission Impossible has made a lot more than that. That is just his salary from Mission Impossible.
No wonder he keeps doing it. Jeez. Okay. I feel like $300 million is probably not out of the realm for the gross revenue of Top Gun. Like, it seems like an absurd number for a movie about toxic masculinity in volleyball. But I'm going to see the second one as soon as it comes out. I think it's more than $285 million.
Okay.
Am I going to disappoint my
drum
friend?
Roll, please. Okay, so we knew that all of that stayed the same. We knew it was over $20 million.
Yeah, of course. I'm so excited. I can't wait.
It's only $179 million. $179,800,601.
So that's national. I really want to know what international, like what it is.
I'm pretty sure a lot more.
I could see that being a very popular box office. Yeah, I'm just curious.
I love Box Office Mojo by IMDb. It's phenomenal. Okay. It is one of my favorite tools. So domestically,
you need
it's
to work for them. You would love this, like the
ranking
stuff. Oh my gosh!
So worldwide, okay. 353.
So worldwide. Okay, so I was definitely more on the. I'm curious, opening, oh my gosh, what a tiny, dismal opening weekend it had.
Yeah.
$1 million.
Only in 1,000 theaters. Like, it's wild.
That's crazy how much has changed since it came out in 1986. So I would not have been allowed to see it when it came out because I was in sixth grade. So I think I probably got to like sneak see it at a friend's house when they rented a VCR to bring to their house.
They rented a VCR?
Yeah, you used to. If you didn't own a VCR, they were super expensive. And if you didn't own one, then you had to rent one at the like Blockbuster, but whatever. And you'd bring home the VCR and then you'd play it at home. And then it was like a big deal once you owned a VCR.
That's wild.
Technology has sped up so quickly. I mean, it's just, it's crazy. Crazy how much has changed since Tom Cruise started making movies.
I don't even remember the last time I saw a VCR.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have any tapes. I think maybe your Grandma Nancy has some.
She probably does, knowing Grandma Nancy.
Yeah, she probably sure has one tapes. Or two.
Well, that is it for our game segment of the show. We're going to go into a song break. I don't know what song to play for Jerry Maguire. What? I don't know what songs are in Jerry Maguire.
I'm going to look them up because I truly have no idea. I don't remember if there was a song from Jerry Maguire. Let me think.
Most of his movies have one song.
Pocket Full of Rainbows is the one that plays at some point. Magic Bus by The Who. It's a weird... Cameron Crowe, usually has some good songs, but I would say...
Free Fallen by Tom Petty might
be
the
move. Yeah, that's probably the one. That is the move because he sings it while he's driving and hitting his steering wheel.
Yeah, that's probably what I'll go with. There's so many songs in this, actually.
There are, but usually it's like with Cameron, because it's Cameron Crowe, right? The director. Yeah, usually his movies are so soundtrack-centric. He loves to do a soundtrack. And I guess this is just one I would never really like lean into. Probably because it's got too much like Neil Young and Paul McCartney. But I still love the movie.
All right. We're going to go ahead and play Free Fallin' by Tom Petty. We'll be back after this.
Hello and welcome back. You're listening to Radio DePaul. I'm Connor Mudd, and this is Tom Talks. It is the time of our show where we talk a little bit of a synopsis and fast facts and data breakdown for the movie of the day. The movie we're talking about is, of course, Jerry Maguire, the movie that I was effectively born to, as we heard my mother talk about. So let's start with a little bit of a plot synopsis. This movie is not as wild as some of Tom's movies that we've seen so far. There are not as many twists, not as many turns. It's more straightforward. However, it is so iconic, such a classic film. And I think that's what we want to take away from it. This film is about Jerry Maguire, who is what some could call a glossy 35-year-old sports agent working for Sports Management International. After experiencing a life-altering epiphany about his role as a sports agent, he writes a mission statement about perceived dishonesty in the sports management business and his desire to work with fewer clients to produce a better personal relationship with them. In turn, SMI Management decides to send Bob Sugar, Jerry's protege, to fire him. Consequently, Jerry and Sugar each call all of Jerry's clients and try to convince them not to hire the services of the other. Jerry speaks to Arizona Cardinals wide receiver Rod Tidwell, one of his clients who is disgruntled with his contract. He needs a $10 million contract for his family to live on. Jerry informs him that if he gets injured for the season, he will get no money from the Cardinals. Rod tests Jerry's resolve through a very long telephone conversation, while Sugar is able to persuade the rest of Jerry's clients to stick with SMI instead. Leaving the office, Jerry announces that he will start his own agency and asks if anyone is willing to join him, to which only a 26-year-old single mother, Dorothy Boyd, agrees, who he met earlier in an airport when she lost her son for a moment. Meanwhile, Frank Kush Cushman, a superstar quarterback who is expected to be the number one pick in the NFL draft, initially also stays with Jerry after he makes a visit to the Cushman home. However, Sugar is able to persuade Cushman and his father to sign with SMI over Jerry the night before the draft. Cushman's father implies they decided to go with Sugar over Jerry due to Tidwell's race, stating they signed while Jerry was, quote, in the lobby with the black fella. Ooh, race relations in a Tom Cruise movie, always a little tense. After an argument, Jerry breaks up with his disgruntled fiance, Avery, and then he turns to Dorothy, becoming closer to her young son, Ray, and eventually starts a relationship with her. Dorothy contemplates moving to San Diego as she has a secure job offer there. However, she and Jerry agree to get married, kind of on a whim. Jerry concentrates all of his efforts on Rod Tidwell, now his only client, and he turns out to be very difficult to satisfy. This is the part of the movie where one of the many iconic quotes comes up, the show me the money quote, because Rod Tidwell wants Jerry to show him the money. Over the next several months, the two direct harsh criticisms towards each other, with Rod claiming that Jerry is not trying hard enough to get him a contract, while Jerry claims that Rod is not proving himself worthy of the money for which he asks. One point of contention is that Rod is not very likable and comes across as aloof to the fans. Rod takes Jerry's advice to prove he is worthy of his contract. Rod is playing well and his team is winning. Meanwhile, Jerry's marriage with Dorothy gradually deteriorates and they eventually separate. Very quick marriage, just like Tom's in real life. During a Monday night football game between the Cardinals and the Dallas Cowboys, Rod plays well, but appears to receive a serious injury when catching a winning touchdown, securing a spot for the Cardinals in the playoffs. He recovers, however, and dances for the wildly cheering crowd. Afterwards, Jerry and Rod embrace in front of the other athletes and sports agents and show how their relationship has progressed from a strictly business one to a close personal one, which was one of the points that Jerry made in his mission statement. He then flies home to meet Dorothy, telling her that he loves her and wants her in his life. She accepts, uttering, "You had me at hello." That's the origin of that iconic yet very cliche rom-com line. Rod later appears on Roy Firestone's sports show,
Unbeknownst to him, Jerry has secured him an $11.2 million contract with the Cardinals, allowing him to finish his pro career in Arizona. The visibly emotional Rod proceeds to thank everyone and extends warm gratitude to Jerry. Jerry speaks with several other pro athletes, some of whom have read his earlier mission statement and respect his work with Rod. The movie ends with Ray throwing a baseball up in the air, surprising Jerry, who then discusses Ray's possible future career in the sports industry with Dorothy. Okay, this synopsis left out a lot of the Dorothy stuff, because Dorothy, I know that the actress who played Dorothy said that her role was kind of the audience's perspective, but she really, she's kind of what holds Jerry together. She's here for all of this, and the synopsis that I'm following doesn't really do her justice. So I just want to address that, point that out, that she is a very fundamental part of this movie, and it's kind of writing it off here as a B plot when she's really part of the A plot in and of itself. But I'll talk a little bit of fast facts. The director and writer of this film is Cameron Crowe, who also wrote Almost Famous. He wrote Vanilla Sky. He wrote We Bought a Zoo. So he's done two Tom Cruise things with this and Vanilla Sky, but I don't know. We Bought a Zoo was a little iffy for me. The cast, Rod Tidwell was played by Cuba Gooding Jr. This, of course, is his second movie with Tom Cruise. He was in Few Good Men as well. He's also in Radio and Boys in the Hood and American Crime Story. And in American Crime Story, he plays O.J. Simpson. So he likes to play football players a lot. Dorothy Boyd is played by Renee Zellweger, who you might know from Chicago or Bridget Jones' Diary or Shark Tale. I love Shark Tale. I need to rewatch that one. That one and Surf's Up, those have the same vibe to me. Avery Bishop is played by Kelly Preston, who actually died earlier this year in July. But she was made famous by this and Cat in the Hat and CSI Cyber, which is a little bit more recent. Frank Cushman is played by Jerry O'Connell, who you might know from Stand By Me or Kangaroo Jack or something called The Parody Video Tom Cruise Wants You to See. I have yet to watch it, but I promise that after I record this, I'm going to watch whatever that parody video is, because apparently Tom Cruise wants me to see it. It's a Funny or Die production, so it'll be pretty funny. I'm pretty certain of that. Bob Sugar is played by Jay Moore, who is also in The Incredible Burt Wonderstone and Pay It Forward. Laurel Boyd is played by none other than Bonnie Hunt, who is a phenomenal actress, definitely didn't get enough love in this movie. She has a little book club of divorcees and widows in the film that the synopsis totally threw by the wayside. She's a phenomenal character and a phenomenal actress. She was in Jumanji and The Green Mile and Rain Man, also with Tom Cruise, and Cheaper by the Dozen and Bug's Life. And we've actually talked about one of her characters in a previous episode. She played Sally Carrera in the Cars franchise. So she's a little underappreciated when it comes to this movie. But I think, you know, she's pretty well appreciated in everything else. Marcy Tidwell, Rod's wife, who also is a phenomenally huge character that the synopsis forgot, was played by Regina King, who was in Ray and If Beale Street Could Talk and Cinderella's Story and Boys in the Hood, also with Cuba Gooding Jr. And then Ray Boyd, the little kid who Tom Cruise becomes fond of, is played by Jonathan Lipnicki. This is Jonathan Lipnicki's first role on the big screen. He then became popular as a child actor in Stuart Little and The Little Vampire and Dr. Dolittle. He really likes stuff with little in the title. But he is probably one of my favorite child actors of all time, just because I love the Stuart Little movie. Let me just talk about Stuart Little first. I want to break down the cast of Stuart Little for a sec. Okay, Stuart Little is played by Michael J. Fox. Phenomenal casting choice. Mrs. Little, so the mom of Stuart Little, is played by Gina Davis. You know, from Thelma and Louise. And then, of course, Mr. Little is played by Hugh Laurie. House MD himself is Hugh Laurie. And then Snowbell, the evil cat who lives in this house, is played by Nathan Lane. This is a phenomenal cast for a very, very strange movie about a couple who adopts a mouse instead of a regular child. The premise is weird. Don't get me wrong. The premise is so weird, but I love the cast, and I enjoy that movie. It's very texturally pleasing. Also, with Jerry Maguire, Troy Aikman is in the movie, just as himself, because, you know, it's a football movie, so they have to have at least one football player just be there. This movie did win one Oscar. Cuba Gooding Jr. won Best Actor in a Supporting Role. Tom Cruise was nominated for an Oscar, did not win. Cameron Crowe was nominated. The film editor was nominated. And it was, on the whole, nominated for Best Picture. It, of course, did not win. Okay. Fun facts. This is Tom Cruise's fifth consecutive movie to hit $100 million plus. He's on a hot streak here. Along those same lines, this movie grossed about $153 million, making it the number four film that year. Looking at it from a modern perspective, having a movie that isn't an action movie, because this isn't an action movie, this is a romantic comedy. Having a movie that isn't an action movie, it's not a sports movie. It is a sports movie, but it is a romantic comedy at its core. And it's grossing fourth highest in the nation. I miss those days. I really do. Because this was an original movie. Like, this was a story that hadn't been told before. So it's kind of exciting to see it in fourth slot that year. This does have the third highest Oscar score so far because of how many nominations it got. It's beat out by Born on the 4th of July and Rain Man, which have 13 and 18 Oscar points, respectively. It has 9.5 Oscar points. If you remember, my Oscar points are awarded. Each award receives a different point value. So Best Picture is worth 5 points. Best Actor and Actress is worth 4 points. Supporting Role or Screenplay is 3 points. And then all other awards are worth 1 point. And if the movie's just nominated and didn't win, then it's worth half of the value of what it was nominated for. It really just helps me get more data on everything. Some other fun facts. The hit that knocks Rod Tidwell out in the big climactic moment of the movie took 29 takes and 3 different stuntmen to get right. I can only imagine it hurt. But Tom Cruise wasn't involved in that stunt, so he wasn't getting tackled 29 times. Paula Abdul helped Cuba Gooding Jr. choreograph his touchdown dance. I think that's so funny that Paula Abdul was somehow involved in this random Cameron Crowe movie. There is a scene when Tom is trying to get sponsorships for Rod, and they're on the set of a commercial, and Rod has to ride a camel or stand next to a camel. There's a camel in the movie. And it was actually a nuisance on the set. There are reports that the camel in the film chased Tom Cruise around the set. It bit Cuba Gooding Jr. and it stomped on a crewmate. So that was pretty funny for me to find out. I think that you kind of reap what you sow there. You want a camel in your movie, you're going to have to deal with what camels do. But yeah, this movie, I liked it. I think it's pretty good for it being such a classic movie. I felt I had to rank it very high. If you remember, I'm ranking all of these on 5 categories on scales of 0 to 20, enjoyment, engagement, quality, iconography, and Tom Cruise factor to get a total Metascore out of 100. And this one I ranked pretty highly in most of them. The only one that's even a little bit low is the Tom Cruise factor. He is jumping. He is excited for most of the film, but he's not doing any stunts. He runs like once in the movie, but he doesn't get tackled. He doesn't jump out of an airplane or have a prosthetic mask on his face. I don't even think he rides a motorcycle in this one. There's no car chase. There's nothing like that. And that's what quintessential Tom Cruise is to me. And I understand he's breaking from his formula in this film, but he also doesn't really have a formula at this point in his career. And even in his films that are a little less formulaic, he does some crazy stunts. Like, there's still a chase sequence in The Firm, though The Firm had a much lower Tom Cruise factor because it was a worse movie, less iconic, that kind of stuff. So across the board, I did 17 enjoyment, 17 engagement, 17 quality, 18 iconography, because I think its impact on society was pretty great with all of those phenomenal quotes. And then the Tom Cruise factor, I had it a 13. So that brings it to a Metascore of 82. That is one of the highest scores that we've seen so far. Of course, last week was 89, so that's going to be a little hard to beat. But it's tied right now with Risky Business. And I would say that this is as iconic as Risky Business in a lot of ways, if not more, because the stuff people remember from Risky Business isn't even the plot stuff, but the stuff people remember from Jerry Maguire is actually pertinent to the plot. That's right. I'm calling out the sock sliding scene again because I'm still not over it. I don't know if I ever will be. But that puts it behind Few Good Men and Top Gun. Top Gun's at 87. Few Good Men's at 83. This is at 82. Pretty good film. Pretty good film on the whole. And with that, that's all the time that we have for today. Thank you so much for tuning in. Come back next week when we talk about Eyes Wide Shut. That'll be an interesting one. I'll have to keep it pretty G-rated for the radio. And as always, stay gold, Pony Boy.